From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
As the acrimony directed at the Trump administration from Democrats and the media has continued to intensify, we probed the question of whether or not that acrimony is based in foreign policy changes feared by the establishment and perhaps being looked at by the Trump administration. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero via Skype Wednesday.
I think we're looking at a world that at least a decade ago was making significant strides away from the dominance of the United States. And this has now crystallized in institutions and relationships between nations that did not exist even 5 years ago. For example, the crystallization of a Western Asia alliance between Turkey, Iran, and Russia, trying to broker and sustain peace in Syria. This is very important. The collapse of TPP and China's filling the vacuum with its own free trade, Asian free trade zone, which, as you know, the TPP was a part of Barack Obama's pivot to Asia, the intent of which was to isolate China economically and militarily, or to challenge China militarily in the South China Sea. Seems to be on hold. At least the TPP is no longer a problem. Now, in terms of militarily challenging China in the South Sea, we'll have to see what this Trump administration will do. But without going into a lot of details, what I'm trying to get at is the world has moved rapidly beyond the paradigm of international governance that the United States had been operating in for at least two decades. China is a big player. The Europeans recognize that. They look at China as a stabilizing force in world trade and financial arrangements. And in so acknowledging that, they have to acknowledge a new role for the Chinese currency, the renminbi. Lastly, new strategic alliances, for example, the China-Russia strategic alliance, the Philippine-China-Philippine-Russia strategic alliance. So the world is vastly different. This places American imperialism and American empire in a moment of truth. How to deal with this situation? And I think that is paramount in this configuration of the Trump administration. I think there are contradictions in the administration, but the question is, how will the United States respond to the new situation in the world?
Here in the Western Hemisphere, you might mark the beginning of the rise of multipolarity with the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998 and the things that followed. You could also see with respect to China, for example, trying to parse whether there's a policy that's coming out of this administration. It's been my opinion, my hope, I guess, probably, that the Trump administration, the people, not necessarily in the cabinet, but the people in the deep brain of the administration, see the international condition as unsustainable, see the rise of multipolarity not necessarily as a threat, but a reality and something to contend with, and are looking to engage at that level, because they go into that negotiating room with, you know, an awful lot of assets, the most, you know, largest blocks of capital in the world, the largest military, which, if nothing else, the U.S. homeland would be more secure than just about any, because, you know, with that military, even if they brought it home, nobody could invade the United States. You know, an awful lot of latent productive capacity. And so, you know, going into this administration, it may well be that what they're trying to do is take stock at this point and figure out how to implement a change in policy. And, of course, they're meeting resistance everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a bit more skeptical. I do think that what I see are internal contradictions and even confusion. In fact, his administration statements with respect to foreign policy have really been symbolic, even on immigrants and travelers coming from certain nations. I think that's more symbolic and a political kind of statement to his base. Even the statements with regards to Iran. So I don't, and this is, I think, in lieu of a consistent foreign policy. Now, the only thing consistent about the Obama and Bush foreign policies were war in the Middle East and a regime change in the Middle East and ultimately a pivot to Asia to isolate China. But because this is a difficult time for American imperialism, a real difficult time, and I don't think the Trump administration knows how to deal with it. As you know, a whole number of top people in the State Department have quit in the wake of his election and his policy towards Russia and the Ukraine, by the way. So I don't think they actually know where they're going at this time. And that's not unusual. I don't think the Obama administration had much of a foreign policy either, to deal with the, you know, what I consider to be the inevitability of retreat from a great deal of what was defined as the American Empire and Pax Americana.
Yeah, or a world war, which was the other option open to them.
And
they seem to have deployed the forces for it, so, and we're drilling them.
Yeah.
Looking at, you mentioned the situation, you know, the approach to Iran, the rhetoric towards Iran, and it's, you know, sounding in politics, basically, here, domestic politics, to appease the base. Looking at the reality, the material aspects of it, you know, Trump has this conversation and apparently is going to be meeting with Putin, discussing, you know, a reset of relations between the two, but more specifically, working together to eradicate ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And when you say that, well, the configuration of forces arrayed against ISIS right now are Russia and Iran. And so if he's going to partner with Russia and Iran and the Syrian government, of course, then that means he's partnering with Iran, and this rhetorical, you know, attack has to be reconciled somehow. And I'm wondering if they're trying to figure out how do we implement policy getting from here to there through the political landscape that we inherited and or helped to create to win the election.
Right. Yeah, that's the big question for them. I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't know what they're talking about. He's put together a foreign policy and security side of his administration that are neocons in many ways. Now, you know, having said that, obviously all neocons are not the same. We're finding that out.
Right.
For example, the neocons with Hillary Clinton, maybe the top dogs of neocons, wanted war with Russia and a new no-fly zone in Syria.
Right.
It seems that Trump's foreign policy establishment has backed away from that, and that's good. I think, and you talk about his instincts towards making deals, bilateral agreements rather than multilateral agreements like TPP that no one knew what it meant and what was in it and all that type of thing. Bilateral agreements are far simpler, better understood, and better managed, you know what I'm saying, and more direct. The other thing I think we have to keep our eye on is not only Brexit, but the other dominoes in Europe falling, for example, France, and you can call Le Pen and those right-wingers if you want, but she is talking about withdrawing from NATO and the European Union,
right.
which will have tremendous impact because the two pillars of the European Union on the continent of Europe are France and Germany. So if France withdraws, it leaves Germany. And who is to say what are the long-term prospects for the Angela Merkel government? They're under assault from a wide swath of the German voters. I think the world order in some ways is in a process of change, in some ways from the standpoint of the Western countries, a situation that looks something like chaos and disorder. And that's why so many European countries are looking to China to stabilize the world economy. Well, that comes with a price, of course. I mean, China has its own ideas, its own interests. But nonetheless, we're looking at a vastly different global situation than what existed only a few years ago.
You mentioned the you know, the fact that these things are in flux. You've been on the program Loud and Clear on Sputnik before, with it was hosted by Brian Becker, and you know, they, Brian, and who's also with the Answer Coalition and Party for Socialism and Liberation, have been, you know, basically promoting the view that Trump is going to or is moving towards rapprochement with Russia in order to isolate China and, you know, attack China in one way or another. And you mentioned the discord or the contradictions among the neocons. We have on Brian's website today at Spreaker that Secretary of Defense James Mattis, one of those neocons, said that diplomats should work to resolve the issues in the South China Sea, and China responding to that, saying, "Yeah, you know, this is good thinking, right thinking." So, you know, there are many neocons, of course, who see it entirely differently than Mattis stated it yesterday, and that's what is prevailing, that contradiction throughout that whole group of you know, policymakers for the last 20, 30 years.
I think that's very interesting what you brought up. I hadn't heard that, but that's very important. You know, I have always found it almost illogical, and that doesn't mean logic drives human behavior, right. But I thought it was illogical, the argument that, well, don't take too seriously Trump's rapprochement with Russia and Putin, because he's only doing that because he wants to go to war with China. You know, please, I mean, you know, neither the Russian leadership nor the Chinese leadership are children. They're more sophisticated than most in the American government, most intellectuals in America. I don't think that the Trump administration could so easily break the strategic alliance that exists between China and Russia. I mean, this was many years in the making after decades of hostility between these two nations. So this is a high point in international relations, and in many ways kind of was driving the Obama administration's pivot to Asia. If anyone was playing that kind of a big power game, it was the Obama administration, who wanted to isolate or separate China and Russia. They were ham-handed about it and crazy, I thought. But I think the argument that the only reason that Trump is opposing NATO and the former policy of the United States in the Ukraine and wants better relations with Russia and is not for intervention and regime change and nation building in the Middle East is because he wants to go to war with China, I don't think it makes much sense, and I don't think the argument could hold up in, you know, under any scrutiny. I think that Xi Jinping's speech at Davos, although it was a diplomatic speech and although it upheld the concept of globalism, at the same time acknowledge that China would have to play not a junior partner role, but maybe a key role along with others, other partners in this new world order. And let's be very frank about it. There's only one nation, major power in the world, that wants war, that has been fighting wars since the late 1980s, early 1990s, up to the present time. And that's the United States. China says over and over again, and its military budget bespeaks it, that they want peaceful development between nations with different economic systems and different interests. Russia says the same thing. It is the United States that is the aggressor. Now, the question is, will the Trump administration base its foreign policy upon a new realism that recognizes the changed relationship of economic and strategic forces in the world? Will they recognize that and act upon a realistic basis and be driven by diplomacy and really detente and peaceful coexistence rather than war and regime change?
You know, I think one place we could look for signals on that at maybe the trial balloon level at a smaller scale is, again, Latin America and the Caribbean. You talk about China and Russia, you know, basically saying, look, your internal affairs, your economic arrangements inside your country, your political systems, they're all your business. Right. When you have everything settled there and you want to come to the table and talk trade, talk business, let's do that. Whoever you send is who we'll talk to, and whoever signs those agreements, we assume that you're bound by them and we'll be bound by them as well. This was the innovation in this hemisphere that was previously controlled by the Monroe Doctrine of Hugo Chavez and expressed in a number of groups, structure that was developed during his time as president of Venezuela. It's continued since. I'm talking UNASUR, I'm talking CELAC, I'm talking ALBA, all these different groupings. Yeah. And the Obama administration and the Bush administration before it conducted coups, all kinds of on-the-ground insurgencies, political unrest, economic warfare, as in Venezuela, soft coups, as in Brazil, etc. If Trump wants to signal to China that it wants to change policy, perhaps withdrawing Obama's executive order about Venezuela, maybe pulling back the CIA out of Brazil and Argentina, maybe something with respect to Honduras, where the coup took place, might be places that he could send those signals, you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are many opportunities to really change things from a neocon militarist approach to the problems of the world, especially the global South, to a realism, to a detente. And here, you know, you asked about those who said, well, he wants detente with Russia so he can go to war with China. I think that if the detente with Russia can become the paradigm or the framework through which the Trump administration conducts foreign policy in other regions of the world. That is, detente rather than military aggression, and economic relations as paramount rather than domination and diktat coming from the United States. If the reset with Russia can be the beginning of a reset with nations and regions throughout the world, I think we're looking at something very positive. You know, and I think, and you know, in some ways you're a little more hopeful than I am, but I do agree with you, Don, that if you take just three things, the detente or the aggressively pursuing a new political relationship with Russia, and he's doing it aggressively in the face of tremendous opposition, if you take that plus his commitment not to get involved in regime change and nation building, part of the outgrowth of that was the liberation of East Aleppo and the United States government not going over that. In other words, you know, the Trump administration has signaled that it is not interested in overthrowing the Assad regime. That's number two. And that's huge for the Middle East, a region of the world plunged into turmoil over the last 16 years by the United States. And the third thing is the overturning of TPP. This is huge. Now, on those three things, if the Trump administration can clarify what it is thinking and what it is doing, I believe there is a vast constituency in the United States for that type of realism. And tragically, the left is following the neoliberals who do not want, ultimately, that type of global arrangement where economics and not military policy drives drives American foreign policy.
And finally, you know, over the last year and a half, we've been having these conversations. You've mentioned a number of times your suspicion, or in any event, that you're on the alert for the change, epochal change that may be underway. So looking at the possibility of an actual epochal change underway globally, and sitting all of the things we've just been discussing on top of that superstructure, how do you see all of this playing out as you know, the global economy or the nature of global, you know, integration of humanity changes?
Right. No, this is huge. You know, and I sometimes speak of it as a move, a change of epochs from the epoch of Europe to the epoch of humanity. This is not going to happen overnight, but I think we are in the throes of a change of epochs. This is not just political and economic, it's also civilizational. Because the multiple civilizations of the global South, which for several centuries have been dominated through colonialism and neocolonialism and other means by the Western powers, the Euro-American bloc, I think that is coming to an end. A new renaissance of humanity is possible. But how many in the United States look at the world at anything but a American-centric position? In other words, if it's not good for Americans, it's not any good at all. You know, so You know, you get the slogan, we oppose the Trump agenda. Well, that's a hard slogan, I think, to defend. Take the United Steelworkers of America. Take the United Automobile Workers, two of the most important industrial unions, not to mention the building trades. Take these major centers of the trade unions in this country. When they say, we oppose Trump on X, Y, and Z, but we support Trump on his opposition to TPP and his commitment of $1 trillion for infrastructure development. I think that is the way you do politics. This blanket condemnation and rejection of Trump and his supporters, his voters, is a suicide mission for the left. Now, the neoliberals are not going to win this one. In fact, the Democratic Party, which is which became under the Hillary Clinton campaign the major center of neoliberalism and neoconservatism, the Democratic Party is now in a intense ideological struggle. And on one side, you got Bernie Sanders and Keith Ellison and the Sanders movement, which I think are the outsiders. And on the other side, you got Chuck Schumer and Hillary Clinton in the background, the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton machine and Wall Street. And these sides are waging an intense and really, I think, a battle that might lead to the end of the Democratic Party. And let me tell you why I say this. The irony is that the person who is leading the more progressive side of this, Bernie Sanders, is not even a Democrat. But he represents a huge part of the base of the Democratic Party, you know? So I think that in real terms, we have to look at going forward the capacity to say we are in a crisis, a political crisis. The political elites are divided in multiple ways. The left must stand with the interests of the working class, the poor, and the broad masses of people, and not be drawn into what is essentially a neoliberal corporate democratic party movement to retake power, if not in 2018, in 2020. Or, short of that, maybe to begin the process of an impeachment of Trump. The situation is very fertile. I think the crisis gives hope and points to possibilities for radical change out of the ruins of both political parties. The left, and here you have to again put quotes on it, which is more or less the liberal left, itself is without a compass, without a vision, without ideological clarity. And what you have are amateurish, hysterical, and ultimately failing strategies directed towards, quote, bringing Trump down, which is not going to happen, but it will expend the energy of the what we could call the hard left, and at the end of the day, lead to their weakening rather than what they believe, their strengthening.
Professor Montero, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.